not mostly recent. It's partly what we did with Ed McCann and Boris Altshuler and Kostya Kicheji, who is now at Rutgers, in 2006. And then there was a recent work with John Robinson, Henning Chalmers, on absorbance on graphite, on graphene. And the content of this talk for today is that I would like to make a brief revision of, or basically list properties of electrons in graphene that I'll need for my talk. Most of it has been described in a lot of details yesterday by Michael. I just want to repeat some of those items for the sake of notations and terminology I'm going to use today. And then I'll have two parts in the talk about the transport. One will be addressed one will address experimentalists. So I'll discuss the weak localization and localization in graphene qualitatively. Then I'll go into the formal analysis of different types of disorder in graphene, discuss a particular example of Ed Adams as a part of it, and produce the formal weak localization analysis, ending up with applicable results that can be used to try to distinguish between different types of disorder in material on the basis of quantum transport measures. I'm almost certain I won't have time to talk about conductance fluctuations in graphene, but we recently looked in that, and we found that one can use universal conductance fluctuations, and by studying correlation functions, one can measure temperature in graphene ribbons. Also, we did it for graphene. It's not precisely purely graphene topic, so I'll probably skip it if I'll feel I'm short of time. Okay, the list of what I need and terminology. The most crucial difference in terminology from what Mike and Kostya used today, I'll call what they call pseudospin. I'll call it isospin, simply because I need both words, iso and pseudo, later on in the talk. And let me call the sublattice composition of the electronic wave function an isospin. And then what I need from that is that we have this nice Dirac Hamiltonian, which describes electron on two sublattices. And then the properties of electrons in conduction band for energies above Dirac points, or valence band energies below Dirac points, are such that the direction of this isospin sticks to the direction of the electron momentum. This may be reflected in the form of such a two-component spinner, which is basically the amplitude of the electron wave functions on the two sublattices, where the phase shift between those two amplitudes for electrons close to the center of the valley, close to the Dirac point, depends on the angle theta, which characterizes the direction of the electron momentum on the plane. And this is momentum of the electron in the valley, calculated from precisely the corner of the Brillouin zone. If one uses the definition proposed by Berry some time ago, then one can calculate the adiabatic phase shift that an electron wave function would acquire if you change adiabatically the direction of the electron momentum by rotating by the angle of 2 pi. And either you can do it by using such a wave function and using Berry formula, and then you get the phase shift of pi. Or you can use an argument that when you rotate the direction of the electron momentum by the angle of 2 pi, it's the same as rotating the direction of the vector sigma by the same angle. So you apply the rotation to the spinner when rotation is applied around the third axis, which sticks out of the plane. The sigma 3 operator takes care of that. And then when you apply such a transformation to a spinner, what you get is that you change the sign of the spinner And this phi here is nothing but the Bray phase that should be attributed to the electron motion on the plane. Now, I don't know whether Rothenberg will have a chance to show those slides. I just leave him out of this pleasure. I'm doing that for him. Make a photograph, or actually he can make a photograph, and he actually did make a photograph of this property of electrons to be chiral by seeing what is the sublattice composition of the electron wave function inside the crystal. And this can be done using the angular result spectroscopy. When electron is kicked out from the plane of graphene, then it ends up in the detector, independently of where it started, sublattice A or sublattice B. And when electrons arrive into detector, the waves coming from the two different sublattices, they interfere. So what the detector is measuring is the sum of two amplitudes modulus squared. Of course, there are phase shifts that electron acquires while propagating in vacuum, and those have to be taken into account, and this is the factor in the amplitude in the result of this interference that takes care of that electron propagating vacuum has different lengths of paths in vacuum. Vector k here is the in-plane component of the electron wave number in vacuum, and RAB is just the displacement between two sublattices, A sublattice and B sublattice. And there is also another factor which is sensitive to what was happening with electrons inside the crystal, and this is exactly the phase shift between the amplitudes of the electron on the sublattice A and sublattice B. And this angular dependence of the intensity of the measured alpha signal as a function of the angle around the corner of the Brilling zone is what is telling us that electrons inside the crystal were chiral. So this is the power of angular result spectroscopy that enables one not only to measure those boring linear Dirac dispersion cones, but also to see the structure of the electronic wave functions inside the crystal. Another reason why I wanted to flag this transparency is to stress that if you look carefully, you see that there is a bit of triangulation in the form of the isoenergetic line of the electron as a function of momentum calculated from the Brilling zone corner. And this reflects that there is a bit of triangulation in the dispersion of electron, that in fact dispersion is lattice dispersion, so that those cones eventually will become some complicated surface. And this triangulation will matter later on when we'll talk about the symmetry. So this is one of the examples where the symmetry of the ray vector of the wave number or wave vector is lower than the symmetry of the crystal itself. Here you have a triangulated form of the energetic line. If you fill it with electrons, this will be triangulated form of the Fermi surface. And the crystal itself was hexagonal. Now, yesterday you heard about what distant charges do to graphene. And of course, they have to be taken into account always when graphene is subject to some substrate, possibly contaminated or something lies on the surface of the substrate. So of course, one has to start the analysis by looking at the density dependencies and what changes or what affects the mobility of electrons in graphene. And I am not going to go into that business discussing who can fit those mobilities better. So what will be the purpose of my consideration today? It will be to look at the relatively high density of electrons in the system. So the layer of graphene is doped using the underlying gate. Looking at this region where the electron momentum is large, so that we can talk about a large P Fermi L parameter, where L is the electron mean free path and ignore possibilities that the electron density fluctuates because the average density is high enough, there to look what the interference effects of electron waves do, how they modify the conductivity of electrons, how they affect the low temperature transport, and what of this low temperature transport will manifest itself in the magnetoresistance in the system at relatively low magnetic field. So this is what will be the subject of the next step in the logic, which is discussion of weak localization versus anti-localization, which I first want to present using just qualitative arguments. When I was a kid, I read translations from English literature, and my favorite was a translation of the series of Agatha Christie stories. And since I came to England, I bought almost all Agatha Christie books, and I read all of them, and I found that they all are built in exactly the same way, as you may recognize in the following part of the presentation. So you start with reading the book, and you encounter some absolutely clear suspect for the murder. So you think, aha, this is the guy who did the killing. But then you read it, and you are smart. I'm smart. So I think, oh, there is a trick. And it's not him, it's his brother. And then you think, oh, no, it's not his brother. It's the wife of brother. And then you think maybe it was their daughter, but you end up with the first person who actually appeared in the book, the one you sold first. So this is how this logic will actually develop in the following discussion. And it's not going to be formal. I'll try to keep it to the level that even experimentalists can follow. So first of all, what we're talking about. We're talking about small addition to the conductivity, or small addition to resistivity, which is due to the enhancement of the effect of interference in the scattering of electrons from disorder system. So if we scatter electrons from disorder system, then there is an enhancement of, or if we scatter away from disorder system, then there is an enhancement in the backscattering of such wave, which appears due to the interference of the waves which propagate along paths which contain closed loops. And if there is perfect time inversion symmetry in the system, then the phases that electron acquires moving along the clockwise and anti-clockwise direction around the same loop will be absolutely identical. And then if we look at the probability for electrons to scatter in the backward direction, then this probability will be enhanced by this interference term, which will, for the exactly backward scattering direction, will give exactly the same as the calculation where you would ignore the interference effect. So you basically double the probability of electrons to scatter in exactly backward direction. What it means? It means that for the time inversion symmetric system, which is disordered, you will reduce conductivity, and this knowledge belongs to 1980s, when it was understood that in two-dimensional systems, such weak localization correction, the word localization comes from the negative change in the conductivity, and weak comes from this effect, was considered as a small addition to the classical value of the conductivity of the material of the disorder system. In this case, you have some logarithmic dependence of this correction on the parameter tau phi, which characterizes the electron coherence time. Then, if you apply a magnetic field, then you start suppressing the time inversion symmetry, and this usually comes through the logic of the Aronoff-Bohm effect, when the electron picks up different opposite sign of phases when it goes clockwise, not in clockwise direction, encircling magnetic field flux. And because this shape of the electron path is random, this addition, this additional phase is also random, so that you will get the random phase factor in the interference term. And for large enough magnetic fields, you will start suppressing this correction. This correction will then give you a magnetoconductivity or magnetoresistance. Magnetoresistance will be positive, will be negative, and magnetic conductivity will be positive, which means that by changing magnetic field, by increasing magnetic field, you will make conductivity slightly larger. In some reasonably high magnetic fields, you would get close to the classical value of conductivity. Of course, in the real life, you will hit somewhere the Schrödinger of the gas oscillations, so the high magnetic field part of such curve is always a complicated dependence. This is the first aspect in our story. If you take a disordered system, what do you expect from it if it's studied at low temperatures? Weak localization, magnetic resistance. Now, here is the first but in this, and this is related to the Berry phase. So if we now add the knowledge of the Berry phase that we have to take into account when we draw the electron propagating in the clockwise and anticlockwise direction along the same loop, then we'll find that the weak localization is replaced by the anti-localization. So how does it come? First of all, we can follow what electron experiences due to the Berry phase, what the electron wave function experiences due to the Berry phase. When electron enters, goes in the anticlockwise direction around the loop, or and compare it with the complex conjugated of the additional phase that electron gets when it enters, goes anticlockwise direction, and then goes out. In each of those cases, the direction of the electron momentum changes by the angle of pi, because electron enters and leaves in this, along the same line, so the momentum turns to the angle of pi. And as compared to what we discussed before, what we need to do is that when we discuss the Berry phase, we need to take into account that we have to look at the complex conjugated phases. So what electron moving in the clockwise direction acquired for the complex conjugated factor will have to take the additional phase that electron moving in the anticlockwise direction acquired and subtract it. So that the effect will be exactly the same as if we have turned the direction of the electron momentum to the angle of 2 pi rather than pi. And this will give us exactly the Berry phase factor in front of the interference term, which will make it definitely negative. And then it will mean that the backscattering, instead of being enhanced, is now suppressed. And in terms of observables, this will mean that the conductivity in such a system should be higher than classical conductivity. And by applying magnetic field, the low field value of conductivity should start decreasing and eventually reach the classical value at some higher magnetic field. So this is the second suspect in the story. Instead of weak localization, one may expect anti-localization in graphene. And that has been the suggestion of Sunia Anda in 2002, safely before graphene has actually been manufactured. There is another twist in the story, and this twist is related to that graphene is not perfect, and also, you may say, also symmetry matters if you have high densities, and you would need to look at larger Fermi energies where the warping or triangulation of the Fermi line of graphene band structure starts playing a role. And some disorder types play a similar effect, and we'll discuss it a little bit later when I'll talk more about disorder. Here I just want to, I'm not saying that this is the most important factor in why this next week happens, but it is the easiest example where you can see that the actual symmetry of the crystal is important to change just naive expectations on the basis of Dirac spectrum. So what I do here, I take electrons in one valley, where I take the small triangulation of the Fermi surface into account, and then I compare phases of the wave propagating along the closed loop in the clockwise and anti-clockwise direction. In each case, the same segments will be passed in the opposite directions, and passing them in the opposite direction will mean that I take electrons with the opposite values in directions of the velocity, and they will appear on almost opposite sides of this slightly triangulated Fermi surface, and because it's slightly triangulated, there's no more circle, P and minus P positions will not have exactly the same wavelengths, and wave numbers. And because of that, there will be a finite phase shift that will distinguish between the amplitude of the and the phase of the clockwise and anti-clockwise propagating wave. So if you take this into account, and as I said, some types of disorder also lead to similar effects, then you would say, well, if we look at really low temperatures, long values of the phase coherence time, where trajectories are long enough so that the corresponding phase difference would be accumulated to become sufficiently large, then in that regime we would not expect any weak localization or any weak anti-localization to appear. We'll just stick to the classical value of conductivity, and maybe at some high magnetic fields we'll start seeing some glimpses of the anti-localization behavior. So this is the pre-last twist, because there is the final detail we have to take into account when we think about graphene. And this is that there is not only one valley, there are two valleys in graphene spectrum. And when one talks about the time inversion symmetry in the system, the time inversion symmetry has to be treated taking both valleys simultaneously into account. And the reason is that when you change time to minus time, you not only have to change the momentum p of electron to minus p, but you also have to change the valley state of this electron. And this is by a very simple reason, because the valley is nothing but the large value of electron momentum in the corner of the Brillouin zone. If you change time to minus time, you have to change the sign of that one as well. And this symmetry is perfectly preserved. And if you compare the two electrons, one in this valley with momentum p and the other in the opposite valley with momentum minus p, and propagate them in the opposite directions along the same loop, then they will acquire exactly the same phase. What it means? It means that if electron's life is not prescribed to stay, to all happen in one valley only, so if electron scatters between valleys all the time, then the interference between electrons which propagate along the same loop in the opposite directions, passing each of those segments in the opposite valley states, and having also the opposite directions of their momenta, those waves will interfere and will systematically produce the usual weak localization type contribution to the conductivity. So what you should expect from that is that there will be just the normal weak localization effect in graphene, however, with a small difference from what we started from. The weak localization behavior in the magnetoresistance, so the magnetoresistance will saturate at the magnetic field, which is related to the intervalley scattering time, or the length of the at which electron will find out that it can change the valley state, rather than just the usual logarithmic dependence, which lasts until the magnetic field will start giving you the flux quantum through the area comparable to the square of the electron mean free time. So that the weak localization effect that would correspond to such a system would tell us what is the intervalley scattering rate in this material. And because of that, the information about the intervalley scattering can be extracted from the basis of weak localization measurements. And to be able to do that, one just has to use the standard equations. And in the more formal analysis, I'll just flash what the standard equations are. So this is the end of the qualitative part. So if anyone has questions, I'm happy to answer, because now I'm going to switch gear and to address more formal description of what different types of disorder should do in graphene from the point of view of symmetry, and specify what we would expect for a few particular cases when the disorder in material is due to at atoms due to doping. Yes. Now, in bilayers, first of all, you don't expect anti-localization at all. you would expect weak localization. But then the trigonal warping and the symmetry breaking disorder will be killers for that, unless there is intervalley scattering. If there is intervalley scattering, then you again get the usual weak localization behavior, and as in the monolayer, it will be saturated at the magnetic field scale related to the intervalley time. In bilayers, the effect of the warping at low density is much stronger because of the bend structure. So there, I would say the effect of bend structure is much more important than the effect of disorder. Can we wait until I will show what the experimental findings were. And this is system dependent. It depends what do you put as disorder. Now, in all the calculations that I'll do, I'll stick to this regime of high densities. And what may be happening with the minimum conductivity, depending on the symmetry of disorder, I can only extrapolate from knowing what symmetry class we should get for a particular system. So what we start with is the Dirac Hamiltonian, which is loved by everyone. It is so beautiful and so simple. And then we start adding the disorder to it, and this makes life much richer in terms of variety of what you can eat. And then we need to use some formalism. We need to use some basis. And the basis that we are using was the four-component vector, where the two upper components are related to Van der Lee. So that's why we use two words, isospin and pseudospin. So there is a sublattice composition to which we give the name of isospin, and there is the and there is the valley index, which also will play a role similar to spin, and for that we reserve the name of a pseudospin. So about symmetries, so with those four component vectors, they actually provide us with irreducible representations of the symmetry group of the crystal. In my experience, this is the first time, except when I studied gallium arsenide, when I actually had to use the symmetries of the crystal and invariant. Yeah. Conduction band is and here, the corner of the Brillouin zone is a particular point because that's where you have so two corners of the Brillouin zone give you the four-dimensional reducible representation of the symmetry group of the honeycomb lattice, which involves rotations from the point group and also translation. The way how it's convenient to describe everything is to deal with generators that by multiplying will give you the all elements of the entire group. And the elementary generators we picked up to just do the calculations were just elementary translation in the horizontal direction, then rotation by the angle of 15 degrees, which swaps A and B sides and also swaps the valleys, and also the mirror reflection with respect to the horizontal axis, which swaps A and B sides but does not change the valley state of the two components, of the four component scheme. Then the next step in building up a formal description of graphene was to find out what we can use as 4x4 matrices, because those are needed to construct the Hamiltonian that acts on the four component spinners. And to do that, we use the usual technology. We know how wave functions transform, and from that we can find how matrices transform, from the knowledge of what the form of 4x4 matrices representing the elementary transformations from the symmetry group of the crystal. And because we have 4x4 matrices, they form 16-dimensional space of matrices. And from the point of view of crystalline symmetry group, those 16-dimensional space splits into reducible representations. And to systematically describe those, we needed to make one sidestep just to have some matrices to play with and to use them to construct the building blocks in the Hamiltonian. The way how we did it was we introduced three matrices, those sigmas, which we now call the true Eisenstein matrices. They are nice, they form the algebra of SU2 symmetry group, so they can be treated as usual spin. And those matrices are very similar to sigma matrices that we used to act on the sublattice components of the four component spinner, except that we have to be careful taking into account signs in different valleys standing in front of those sigmas and distinguishing between how sigma z is constructed as compared to sigma x and sigma y constructed. And we also built another set of three matrices which also behave exactly like spins, which mostly act on the valley state of the electron. This you can see from that this matrix is the off diagonal in the valley block, and that's why we call it valley pseudospin, just isospin and pseudospin to distinguish sigmas and lambdas. The nice thing about this set of matrices is that they can use so that operations with those are very simple. For example, if you would have a Hamiltonian which would not include either of those, neither sigmas or lambdas, then you can describe electron states which are described as a Hamiltonian using quantum numbers that would be kind of isospins and pseudospins considered separate. If a Hamiltonian contains some combination of sigmas and doesn't contain combination of lambdas, then using the operators lambda or the algebra of those lambdas as a way to identify quantum numbers, you can always use either pseudospin quantum numbers to characterize any object, single electron object or two electron object you wish. Now, how we use those matrices? Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. So at the moment we just constructed some convenient objects. So the next step is to use those objects to classify irreducible representations of the symmetry group of the crystal. Now what we can do? We can pick up some of those and check what happens to them if we apply elementary transformations from the generator. So if we take sigma z or lambda z or their product, and those are diagonal both in the isospin space, in the sublattice space, and in the valley space, then we find that they do not change except they acquire a factor. So those provide us with one-dimensional irreducible representations of the crystalline symmetry group. In the tables, you can even find the names for those representations, A1, A2, B1, B2. Then we can start taking something more sophisticated. We can take pairs, and apparently if we take pairs of sigma x and sigma y, or lambda x and lambda y, when we start seeing how they transform, we find they transform one into the combination of those two when we apply some of those transformations. And if we take the products of lambda z with either of two sigmas, or sigma z with either of lambda x or lambda y, they also provide us with another pair which transforms through each other. And this gives us a list of four two-dimensional reducible representations of the symmetry group of the crystal. And finally, if we take the product of sigma x, sigma y, and lambda x, lambda y. This will give us four matrices which will transform through each other, and this will be the four-dimensional reducible representation of the crystalline symmetry group. And this is the largest you can have for this crystalline symmetry group. And if you now count how many we have, you will find that we first of all listed all possible, and second that we got exactly 15 matrices. And if you now add the unit matrix, this will be 16 matrices, which are needed to expand absolutely any 4x4 matrix. So this is the appropriate basis. And in other words, we have another way to write down the generators of the SU, well, actually not SU, but U4 group that governs transformations of four components. Now, one more transformation we have to keep in mind to be kosher, and this is a time reversal symmetry. And when we look at this transformation, we have to remember that when those lambdas were involved, they were related to the valleys. And when sigmas were constructed, we played this small trick that in the two valleys, the form of components of 2x2 blocks in sigmas were different, so that when the valley transformation is applied, so when we invert time and change from one valley to another, then each of those three sigmas and each of those three lambdas separately change sign to the opposite. So what it means, that these guys invert signs with respect to time inversion. So sigmas, vector of two sigmas, they behave similarly to the electron momentum. And if we construct the Hamiltonian, we have to be very careful not to use those sigmas and those lambdas separately unless they come together with another operator which changes the sign when time inversion is applied. Of course, unit matrix is invariant with respect to time inversion. And since sigmas and lambdas change sign upon time inversion, then any product of any sigma and any lambda will give us the invariant of T minus T transformation. So that the direct product like this, so the product of sigma I lambda j, can be used in expanding the disorder into the matrix form, if this disorder is time inversion symmetric. So this is the sketch of what building blocks we now have. We have convenient expressions. We have convenient operators that we introduced, you may say, simply by chance. We studied how those products, how those operators, sigmas and lambdas, together provide us with irreducible representations of the symmetry group of the crystal. The number of all matrices we classified and found how they change with respect to time to minus time inversion is exactly what we need to express any 4x4 matrix. So this is the basis to be used in the representation of the disorder. So this is a Hamiltonian that we now write down in the form of those operators, sigma and lambda, in terms of the isospin sigma and pseudospin lambda. This is the familiar Dirac term, which now looks very, very simple. Then you can look at the warping term, which doesn't look that pleasant. And if you start counting powers of sigmas and lambdas, you'll find that there is an even number in the product. And this is because this term is quadratic in the electron momentum. And then when we build up the representation for a generic disorder, what we have to do is to use all possible products of sigmas and lambda. And then what we need to do in the next step is to identify particular combinations, or physical meaning of particular combinations, or some image for particular combinations of sigmas and lambda. And obviously, these are those combinations that provided the irreducible representations of the symmetry group of the crystal. So we just go through the list. Well, this is the simplest one. This is the potential disorder, which is proportional to the unit matrix, which will be present almost whatever you do to the sheet. Then you can look at lattice deformation. And the way how I actually prefer to look at lattice deformations is to make analogy with the lattice phonons, with in particular optical phonons, because those have been classified in Raman spectroscopy very well. And all those representations we discussed before, they are also identifiable as representations of the crystalline symmetry, providing us with particular phonon modes. So the simplest phonon you can imagine is a phonon in the middle of the Brillouin zone, in the gamma point. The optical phonon will give you displacements of A sublattice with respect to B sublattice, characterized by some displacement vector. And if you apply such a phonon distortion to the lattice, then you will produce a perturbation for the electron, which will look like this. There will be some vector which is related to the displacement vector of one sublattice with respect to the other, and this will come together with the parameter, with the matrix sigma. The matrix sigma coming with this vector is due to that you change the length of the bonds, and therefore you change the hopping, so that this is why the AB of diagonal matrices appear here. And to make it time inversion symmetric, you must have the factor of lambda z. Then it was realized by Paca and Alberto Merpurga, and I think this has already been known before to Andreas, who's sitting there, that this kind of disorder means the same as a fictitious magnetic field. If you take rotor of such a vector and if it's not zero, then you can identify it as some magnetic field, because you can write down the whole Hamiltonian, the kinetic energy term plus the perturbation. You can take out the sigma matrix out, and then what will be left inside will be P plus some vector potential. And what is important here is this vector potential has lambda z matrix in front of it, and this lambda z matrix tells us that whatever fictitious magnetic field will have to describe Lattin one valley, then in the opposite valley it will have the opposite sign, so that all over the in the crystal the time inversion symmetry will be preserved. Also, in one valley, when Lattin would stay there for life, it would find out something that would affect this motion as if there was a magnetic field in the system. So that this is the effect that would suppress the weak localization or anti-localization. Sorry? Well, it doesn't matter how you, what energy you invested to provide such deformation. Well, if you start bending, when you bend or when you stretch, you always mix up deformations of two types. Because of that, when graphene is corrugated, then you start generating terms of that. Yeah. But later on, I would say in 5 minutes, you will see that also I identify a particular term according to some lattice deformations, which is visually simpler. They can be generated by a very different way, by putting, spitting on graphene. This is the bond disorder. You can also imagine you distinguish the on-site energies on the A and B sublattices. So this way, you generate this term sigma z lambda z. Would this be homogeneous across the system, then this would open a gap. If you open the gap, then you start killing all these nice effects of chirality of electrons. And just a simple logical argument would tell me that the effect of such disorder would lead to exactly the same as the example we discussed on the previous slide. It would suppress the effect of the anti-localization. It would start suppressing the interference contributions to the conductivity due to electrons which never change their valley state. There is also disorder that can scatter between valleys. To describe those, we need to use the matrices lambdas, which are off-diagonal, so the matrices lambda x or y. And according to what I told you about the reducible representations, we have two types of disorder. One where you have those x, y's, both in sigmas and lambdas, or you have sigmas that multiply by one of two lambdas, x or y lambda. And these two types of disorder can be identified to deformations provided by optical phonons, but not in the middle of the Brillouin zone, but in the corner of the Brillouin zone, in the K-point, like the K-point of an electron. And the phonons in the corner of the Brillouin zone, they are known to have one non-degenerate branch, and similarly to electrons, to have two modes which appear at the same energy exactly in the corner of the Brillouin zone, so that there are four different displacements you can identify to the symmetry class. And this is the analogy I'm trying to drive with the optional form of disorder, which can be produced by any other means, right? And then this type of disorder would produce the intervalley scattering that would restore the weak localization behavior in the system. And this is the intervalley scattering time determined by this kind of disorder that may be measured and looked at by studying the weak localization. Now, I said that we also looked at the effect of symmetry breaking by Ed Adams. And funny enough, we did it with Ed a little bit before we knew that graphene exists. Then the paper was published already after, but we did it for the sake of carbon nanotubes. And what we did, we just looked at three more symmetric ways to put a perturbation inside the unit cell of graphene. So we can put one in the middle hexagon, and this is where alkyl atoms typically take position. You can put one on the site of hexagonal lattice, and this is what hydrogen dumps, according to what Costa told us and what Katznelson calculated. And the oxygen sits halfway between, and this is the famous epoxy bonding that is known in chemistry. Of course, all of those atoms, they are not inside the plane, they are probably above the two-dimensional plane. So when I'm saying in the middle, it's in the middle when we look on vertices from above. For each of this type of disorder, you can identify the remaining symmetry in the system. Because if you take this one, for example, you can rotate lattice around and you still get the same picture. If you take this one, you can reflect with respect to the horizontal axis and then you don't change anything. With this one, you also can have a thorough transformation. For example, you can reflect with respect to vertical line. Or you can rotate the unit cell and then displace to put this atom back in the position where it was. And all these transformations, they produce some subgroup of the symmetry group of the crystal. And according to that subgroup, we have to require that upon such transformations, the form of the Hamiltonian should not change. And what it means, that for each of those particular examples, not all terms that I listed in the previous slides are possible. You have to be selective, and you have to identify for each of the examples which term are permitted. There are two ways to do that. We actually have done it the most complicated way. We just looked at particular example and constructed all terms that are permitted. Much easier is to take any of those irreducible representations that I described, that I mentioned in the previous part of the talk. And for each of them, you can identify what positions of impurities are such that the corresponding term does not change upon the transformations that do not change the impurity position if you combine several of them. For example, what you can do, you can look at the simplest configuration when you put the atom in the middle of the hexagon. And in this case, the only permitted terms, they are either the one which looks like the effect of Coulomb scatter, plus the intervalley term, which has only two optional matrices, the product of lambda x, or lambda 1, y, and sigma z. The interesting thing that I would like to mention now is the following. When you look at one atom, you would say there should be just one form of the disorder. What I show here in the slide is an expression where for an atom which is placed somewhere, I allow this combination of lambdas to take one of three different forms. How come? The point is that when you have intervalley scattering, you transfer momentum, which corresponds to the momentum difference between two brillings and corners. And when you have scattering, the form of the scattering amplitude depends where exactly in space you have put your scatter. And the form of disorder was an oscillate with a period which is determined by the transferred momentum, which is the momentum between momentum difference between two brillings and corners. And what I did here, I just used three different colors, green, red, and yellow, to identify three different unit cells, three different hexagons, where the values of this vector v would be different. If I put my impurity here in the green hexagon here, or there in the green hexagon there, this perturbation it creates for electrons would look exactly the same. If I put them if I put this impurity in one of the red ones, I have to use different form of this vector v. And there are three different I can use, and this tiling just would tell me which one to use depending where the impurity position is. And for this example, you can see that for example, alkali atoms, I'll have the symmetry class in the problem where the scattering will be dominated, or maybe dominated by the most symmetric scattering process, plus it would immediately include the intervalley scattering, and what you would expect in this case would be definitely weak localization from a start, and weak localization forever. Another thing you can do is you can look at the symmetry class which characterizes hydrogen, and there the life is a little bit richer. First of all, you can put hydrogen on A side or B side, then you will have the AB asymmetric term in the Hamiltonian. And you can have also the intervalley scattering taken into account. And this is taken into account slightly different form. It appears in the form of products of sigmas and lambdas, where you use the four-dimensional reducible representation to construct such disorder. And the way how those matrices can be constructed is actually you take the symmetry group, and then you take one matrix to start with, and then you build the set, which is nothing but the orbit of the group. Now you notice that I have some matrix structure here that has the coefficients. Those coefficients, they actually form matrices themselves, 2x2 matrices, because there are indexes which take values of x and y. And there are six different matrices you can use to characterize the hydrogen atom in this formula. And this will depend, again, as before, in which of those tiling hexagons it will be inside, so which size within this larger size hexagon it will take. And since there are six optional choices, then there will be six different matrices you can use. This is only seemingly simple. well, not, first of all, not all terms in the Hamiltonian are present. And this simplicity is only because we look at one single atom. So now I'm going to hit you hard, because if you put many of those atoms on the scale of the electron wavelengths, then what electrons with the wavelengths much longer than the distance between those and atoms will see will not be the effect of just one. Electrons can virtually scatter into a large momentum state and then scatter from another atom into back into the lower momentum state. And this virtual scattering will automatically start mixing up everything in the disorder parameters that we have introduced. And what it will mean in practice, it will mean that when we determine what one impurity does individually, we should characterize it at a very short length scale, and then we have to use some renormalization group method to find out what set of parameters characterizing disorder in the system will be when we'll talk about electrons which have the wavelengths much longer than atomic distances and much longer than the distances between atoms. There is a horrendous renormalization group equation which has been derived first by Larner and Efetov, and then it was slightly improved by Stokowski, Gorin, and Mirlin, which actually wrote it in the way how it is very convenient to analyze numerically. And using these equations, you can start with knowledge of what microscopic parameters should be attributed to one scatter and end up with the set of parameters that can be used to characterize electron scattering with electron wavelengths, which is larger, which is longer than the typical distance between individual impurities. We played with this a little bit, looking at adsorbate-induced disorder in graphene. We used a model that we believe is applicable to the description of hydrogen on graphene. So we, the simplest version of the model is that we just attach an ed atom which has some resonant energy level and which is hybridized with graphene electrons, with graphene states. Then we get rid of the ad atom itself, just calculating scattering amplitudes for electrons in graphene, where the resonance is moved down towards the zero in the density of states of graphene. This is just the usual thing in level of repulsion. The added level is shifted towards where the density of states in the system with large number of states is lower. And then we can have the description of what one atom does. It does exactly what we expected on the basis of symmetry, that there are three types of contributions which are present. The one which is the most symmetric, then there is a sigma z lambda z term, and the term which scatters between valleys, and two coefficients were zero, so the other two were not present initially. But then after we use all this renormalization group technology and calculate what electron with the wavelength, which is much longer than the distance between the atoms would see, we find that the electron will see the system as if all types of disorder are present, and they renormalize in the way that the most symmetric is enhanced, the intervalley scattering is enhanced, and this other terms they have been generated, where this one went down. So you may end up, you may start with a system where you think you know what disorder is. If disorder is too dense, you have to be very careful to describe what's happening with the longer wavelengths, because you see here, you start generating all types of disorder. Also, you have started with two types of disorder completely out. We played with numerics, and we did two calculations, in particular in relation to hydrogen. We calculated the scattering amplitudes for one ad atom, and then used the RG equations to describe the scattering rates already for long wavelength electrons and looked at what happens with different coverage of graphene with ad atoms. Maybe some of those coverages are not realistic. This is the number of ad atoms per unit cell. So this is like 10 to the minus 3, and this is too high coverage probably to talk about it seriously. And so what we start with is we calculate the scattering amplitudes at the at a single atom. Then we calculate the scattering times related to that, plug them into this set of renormalization group equations, which characterize scattering rates. Well, these are the crossing diagrams.
Yeah.
We renormalize this order. These are not diffusions or cuprons yet. We want to find what to use to describe electrons at the scale of the electron wavelength. Yeah. Well, No. But the steps are prescribed, and we kind of were prepared that it's going to be messy, but what you start seeing here is that even if we know what you had at the beginning, in terms of, let's say, hydrogen, you know what to expect for just one hydrogen, what you end up as parameters of this order for relative large coverage that gives you more than one hydrogen per electron wavelength, this is already has nothing to do in its analytic form as compared to what you have just for one hydrogen. But what matters here from the point of view of transport characteristics that I'm interested in quantum transport is that this parameter beta perperpendicular, which characterizes the intervalley scattering, it went up, it was the largest, it went up, remained large, and it means that in such a system, the intervalley scattering will be strong, and therefore, in terms of quantum transport, this should be a system where you should expect weak localization in high densities of electrons or full localization at low densities of electrons. So this two plots on the top, they show on the left what we got when we used the RG approach to determine the scattering rates and then plug them in the kinetic formula. And the right-hand side was the quantum transport computation on the lattice that Henry Schomers did. And they are in reasonable agreement one with each other, showing that for relatively large coverage, like 2% area covered by hydrogen, you get a wide range of Fermi energies where conductivity is indistinguishable from nil. And this is really indistinguishable from nil because this calculation is done in the way that what we calculate specifically ignores the quantum interference effects at long distances. So if you take those into account, all that would be the region of localization behavior. So the last thing I want to do is to use all to flash these results about weak localization, or better, to plug this into weak localization. I agree with you. So what this shows is the calculation that we would attribute to high temperature, and what I'm saying is that if now we would think about low temperature, because there is a lot of intervellar scattering, the intervellar scattering is dominant, then we should have all this localized and therefore hopping conductivity of whatever kind. Now, the last thing I want to do is to plug all this description of disorder into the formal weak localization analysis. And there is a standard technology for that. One expresses the correction to conductivity in terms of some two electron correlation functions. And the way how these two electron correlation functions can be classified in graphene is that we now have those nice quantum numbers, the isospin sigma and pseudospin lambda. And depending on what terms are present in the Hamiltonian, both in the warping, in the kinetic part, in the form of warping, and in disorder, we can determine which of those quantum numbers conserve. And the rule is the following. If there is a conserving quantum number, you can keep a two-particle correlator that has that quantum number. If the quantum number is not conserved, then you have to say that the corresponding Couperon is suppressed, and the relaxation rates that we discussed that characterize different disorder symmetries, they characterize how fast those two-particle correlations would decay if we would follow them in real time. So this is how we can do that. So there are following, there are the following, by the way, before I go to the next slide, I have to say the following, that our Hamiltonian has the kinetic term, has the Dirac term, which is always there, and there are some impurities that change the direction of electron momentum. We're talking about disorder system. And because the electron momentum changes its direction, it means that the operator sigma, the vector sigma, will also change its direction all the time, so that the only quantum numbers that we can attribute to the pair of electrons that would not relax is the total isospin equal to zero, so that all the couperons we have to take into account, they can only be singlet couperons in terms of the this isospin. And then if we calculate, as you said, Hakami boxes, we find the numerical coefficients in front of those, and we'll have three couperons, kind of zero z components and plus minus one z component of this total pseudospin lambda. They will come with pluses, and the full singlet, which is singlet both in the pseudospin sector and isospin sector, will come with a minus. So if I would have all four of them present, so if I would have no intervalley scattering, for example, no symmetry breaking effects at all, then I would have four positive, three positive winning over one negative, so I will have the positive contribution to the conductivity. This would be the weak anti-local localization that is specific to the Dirac particle. Now, if we take into account the symmetry breaking terms, we'll find the following, that if there is symmetry breaking disorder of any type, and if we also take into account warping, then the couperons, which are the same valley couperons, the couperons which are triplets plus minus one projection onto that axis triplets in the pseudo spin lambda sector, they will be dead. And their death is prescribed by the relaxation rate or lifetime, which is a combination of effects coming through the warping, coming from the disorder that breaks symmetry without scattering between valleys, but also intervalley disorder does the same job. Then if we take into account, and then what happens if we permit for this, those two couperons are dead, there are two couperons which are left. They have the same contribution of the opposite sign, so they will simply cancel each other. And this is a situation we described in the beginning of the talk as no weak localization or anti-localization regime. And this will happen in the system where the intervalley scattering is not present. But if there is intervalley scattering, then of course this couperon will be also dead. And then the only one which is not affected by any elastic time inversion symmetric perturbation is the one which is complete singlet, which behaves like an electron density. And this one can be affected only by the decoherence, and this one will provide us with the usual weak localization behavior. So this is the sketch which shows different regimes. You can expect playing with relations between different time scales, into valley time, or the time which breaks symmetry within one valley. And the red curve is the one which is most naturally to expect if everything is present in the system, including the intervalley scattering, and this corresponds to the positive magnetic conductivity when conductivity increases with the magnetic field. So these are the few experimental results that exist in literature. Some of them are shown as the resistance dependence on magnetic field, so I flip those upside down. And what you can see is that there is weak localization, which is saturated at relatively low magnetic fields. And recently, the group of Alex Savchenko used the measurement of weak localization as technology to quantify the amount of different types of disorder in the system, specifically the intervalley scattering. Now, this is the answer to your question, which is present, and the answer is theoretically, if you start with something you think you know what it is, you may end up with mass. You can only say that there is a good chance to have a lot of intervalley scattering. In the samples which were not specifically polluted by adsorbents, the intervalley scattering appeared to be weak, and that's what Savchenko found, and those who are interested to look at it in more detail, I put all the references to the slide. The last thing I want to say is that if you now make a nano ribbon or just a narrow ribbon of graphene, then edges will automatically produce the scattering between valleys, unless of course they are ideal and very theoretical. And if they're realistic, you will get the same situation as in graphene with strong intervalley scattering, which means weak localization in the regime of high densities and definitely a localized state, as actually everyone sees in the nanoribbons nowadays at low density. So this is the end of the menu for today. I went through this a bit slower than I would like to, and I'll not tell the story about the conduction fluctuations. And the message I would like you to take from this talk is that if one wants to quantify the information about the intrinsic properties of disorder, maybe not seeing all the details, but at least one can find out how much intervalley scattering is happening in the system, and then use it to improve the systems if you know what to do about it. So thank you very much.